progress.
Okay. I have a lot I want to do today, and I want to actually do something a little special when I finish up Meir Kahana as objectively as I can. I want to go into a little deeper and be a bit subjective and analyze and reveal some secrets that won't put me into jail today. If I had revealed this before 202, I might have wound up in jail, but they canceled the security clause, at least I'm under three security clauses. That one was canceled in 2002. Dov, it's good to see you. Welcome back. It should be only better health and wonderful health. First of all, let's begin properly. Today is October 11th, 2021, and we're enjoying some wonderful weather here in Yerushalayim, and just should be Besara Tovot in addition. I want to say to Charlie, was this ever your Rebbe, Harav Hagon Avraham Erlanger?
Kol Torah.
So he just died, and I'm reading about him that he was someone very, very special.
I was there a long time ago.
A long time ago, I understand. But he was your Rebbe when you were there.
Yes.
And then I read here very interestingly that he would never leave Eretz Yisrael. He said even though he was here in some difficult economic times, and the Rambam Paskins based upon the Gemara and Ketuvah, you're allowed to leave Eretz Yisrael, one of three reasons. But he said it's only a b'diavet, not l'chatchila. And he says with the whole story of Ruth and Naomi and her husband, they were punished because they left Eretz Yisrael. Even though they were allowed, it was a time of tremendous heartache and lack of food. So very interesting. I am moved by what I read about him, although I don't ever recall meeting him. And Erlanger, he was of German origins to begin with.
Swiss already.
He was in a Litvak. That's what I'm saying. A Litvak at the Nishkezen and Ishtapelish Chassid. Okay. I want to mention I got a very interesting letter from South Africa that we spoke about this in Shia. After Shia, I was telling you about the volume of Rabbi Pear and how Rabbi Pear rejoiced when he got a Machal Shabbos open, whose store was open on Shabbos, but at least he didn't smoke. So my Talmud, Ram Wax, if I'm pronouncing it right, W-A-K-S, tells a story that one of the Rebbeim in South Africa asked his Talmidim, what would you do if people said they had to work on Shabbos for Pikuach Nefesh? The old story, this by the way was discussed with America, there's a Chafetz Chaim related to it, and South Africa had the same story that the financial pressures were such that everyone worked on Shabbos Lo Aleinu. He calls it his grandparents' generation. So what would you do? So one student shot out, now tell them not to work. And the Rebbe, Rabbi Kurstak, said, well, if we can't stop them from working, At least let us promise that they won't do one malacha on Shabbos. Tell them to work, but to do something different on the day in order that their children should grow up knowing that Shabbat was not just any other day. And when I subsequently told my sister what Rabbi Kurstak had said, she told me that although my Zayda went to work, he never opened up his mail on Shabbos, okay? And Baruch Hashem, today he has many Shomrei Shabbos descendants. So it shows you what Rabbi Pear advocated, his lifestyle. There's a lot of truth, a lot of insight to it, to show them that the day is different. And if you read the biography of Rabbi Pear, or the memoir about him, it's not a scholarly biography. In other words, it's not put into context, but it's a very personal, moving description of a son describing his father. And there were families where he meets them later in life, and kulam shomrei Torah mitzvot. And I have to tell you out of the rabbinate, if I told you this, stop me. I don't want to waste time. But I had one family, you know, a Hungarian family, big yichus, And they had a big store on Springfield Avenue. This is when Newark was Newark. If you know what Springfield Avenue was, that's like telling you a store on Fifth Avenue, New York, Park Avenue in New York, Madison Avenue in New York. And they did very well. And the store was open Shabbos. And the owner of the store, the patriarch of the family, died. And at the funeral, you know, as a young kid, I don't have to apologize. It hurt me. They were open Shabbos. So I said something at the funeral that there should be more Shmirat Shabbat. And people criticized me at the funeral. What are you bothering them? What are you telling them? What are you putting the knife into them? All right. There was a lesson in the rabbinate. I was pretty discreet. It wasn't. I was already a little mature already in Maplewood, New Jersey. And many decades later in Woodmere, I'm a visiting scholar in residence, and I meet the grandson of the man who I said at that funeral, Shoma Torah Mitzvot 100%, his wife, his children. I had such nachat you can't imagine. And I reminded him of the funeral. And he laughed, you know, Baruch Hashem, Ashrenu Shesachinu. Shmirat Shabbat is the base. When Chazal said, I'll tell you why it's the base, it's very simple. Kashrut and other matters, you can do for many reasons. Health reasons, hygienic reasons, happy sexual life. I don't have to tell you how many books have been written to explain Tarat Mishpacha and Kashrut. The greatness of Shabbat is when you make Kiddush, Vayichol Shmer Haaretz, at that moment you acknowledge there's a God. And once you acknowledge there's a God, the whole return to being a human being created in the image of God and not a walking idol worshiper, that's the start. To acknowledge there's a God. Everything else can follow very smoothly. And that's why Shabbat is so important. And I want to thank Rabbi Grinstein. Something I said in class yesterday. So Baruch Hashem, my memory is good. Rabbi Grinstein sent me a photograph from Rabbi Heschel Shechter's Nefesh HaRav, beginning on page 160, exactly what I said in class. That Rabbi Heschel says, Shemanu me Rabbeinu, that his father, when he walked into the bathroom, took all the coins and shtarad out of his pocket. And the Rav didn't hold like that. He says he has a machlekes goyim. I showed you yesterday, it could very well be a machlekes halacha l'maisa from the Shulchan Aruch and from the Shach. The Shach saves our lives, plain and simple. And he quotes the Rav. I told you too that I heard in the name of the Rav. I didn't ever heard it in class. Maybe I did hear in class. It could be I heard it in the 50s. But if you write God G-D, what's the difference? If it's a euphemism for God, if it has the status of a kinui, then if you write it G-O-D or G-D, according to Rav Heschel, even if you write -, that's what he writes here. But if you know it refers to the Ribbono Shel Olam, then Rav Meisher is Machmir. The Rav was Mekil. The Rav was Mekil. Yeah.
People say Xmas. The X, it's the same thing.
I'll tell you, I was always taught never to say CH because it means our Messiah. So that's why I was told from that Xmas began, because you're not saying our Messiah. Nothing wrong with referring to Christmas.
No, but by them, the X
means say that. I'm not going to get involved with the Shach over Christmas. All right, now I want to pick off where I left off, and I hope to finish out Reb Meir today. And as I said, Reb Meir, the achievements are great. There's no question the JDL and Russian Jewry, and we have to acknowledge it. He was very charismatic, and in Bnei Akiva, myself, my brother, and remember, between my brother and myself, and we have hundreds of direct descendants living in Israel, and this goes back to Meir. He was a big influence on us. The problem with Meir, and I think I gave you the Rakefet twist, I may be right, I may be wrong, But when you have five relatives killed in an Arab ambush, and then afterwards with Howard Beach, where they fire him for putting in a mechitza, it left deep scars on him. And the Rabbi, you know, we were young kids. He went into the Rabbi, he was in his early 20s. I went into the, maybe mid-20s, he was a little older than I am. I went into the Rabbi at 23, and I really have to be Moedel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I survived that first year. It was very, very difficult for me. I came crying to the Rav, and you know, the Rav said to me, he told me, again, we were talking Yiddish, he said to me, that a Rav, who they don't want to throw out of the city, it's a sign he's not a good Rav. And if he lets himself be thrown out of the city, it's a sign he's nishtamensh, that he doesn't know how to handle himself. So it was difficult, and that certainly had influence on Meir. And again, he was headstrong. I've spoken with classmates of his, for instance, Sam Dershowitz, my dear friend, Zichrono Livracha, was his classmate in the first graduating class of BTA. And he said, even then, Meir was stronger than the rest of us, outspoken and dominant in his opinions, and that was Meir. Now, there was a lot of opposition, and as I said last week, when the JDL starts picking up baseball bats to hit people over the head, you're not exactly going to find favor with most Jewish Americans, and even in Israel, it's not going to go over, plain and simple. So Meir finally, after the death of Irene Acronis, that terrible incident with this Hurak, the office, the bomb, Meir shifted attention to Israel and ultimately went back and forth. He was in jail part of the time in America. Then afterwards he's in Israel, and then he goes on to become a Chavek Knesset. In Israel, he called attention to the problems. He told it as it was. And these are problems we live with, we struggle with until this very, very moment. It's in today's newspapers, in the weekend newspapers, and we're not going to escape the problem, are we a Jewish state, are we a democratic state? We're talking now, they're appointing, I don't know if you realize what's going on, but in addition to the Dayanim who are being appointed, and I see what's going on, my daughter on the committee and her picture was in one of the weekend alonim with Chief Rabbi Stern, and the pressure upon her. Well, that's only part of the story. They're now appointing the new judges for the Supreme Court, and a lot depends upon who is being appointed, if they're going to be Haaretz people or if they're going to be Yisrael Hayom people. And in this country, the Supreme Court plays a much more major role than it plays in the United States. As you know, those of you, Charlie's living here almost as long as I am, and Elliot, you're here already a few years, Supreme Court plays a very, very big role. And this question of how do you balance out, and when you deal with Amos Kolak, when you deal with the son of Teddy, where he sits on television, I don't know if he's alive, by the way, it should be checked, but he sits together with his wife, who didn't even bother to convert. She's a non-Jew, and he says, I'm an Israeli, I'm not a Jew. And that played out, by the way, with the Moshe Dayan's son. I think his first name is Uzi, you can correct me if I'm wrong. And when he was an actor for a while. You know, the name Dayan gets you far. And he was in Washington, Hollywood. And they were filming him. And the rabbis of the California area asked them not to film on Shabbos. All kids in the Talmud Torahs and the day schools, their eyes were upon Moshe Dayan's son. It was right after the Six-Day War. And you remember his answer? I'm an Israeli, I'm not a Jew. And that was his answer. He's no longer alive. And this is a real problem.
This is still alive.
Well, excuse me?
Google is still alive.
Amos, oh, happy to hear it. Does it say what he does?
He's a director and a writer.
A director and a writer. Okay, that's what he was doing back in the 70s too. He wrote a volume, and probably wrote more. And this is the heart of the problem. Now, when Meir got involved in Israel already with the problems of Yehuda B'Shomron, Chevron, and he went against administrative orders in Israel. He ultimately winds up in jail. And this is in the 70s into the early 80s. And back and forth, finally a longer jail sentence. It was, all in all, I doubt if he sat in jail more than a total of a year, but there was one, I think it was 5 or 6 months, where it was concentrated. Well, in jail, he faced a terrible Israeli problem that he called to the fore. And a good deal of the modern history of Israel goes back to this, and this is the Sfardim. And I quote Meir, and he coined a term here. He invented a word. I spoke about this years ago. He used the word gentilized Israelis. In other words, an Israeli, a nice Israeli, you read Haaretz, here it's in Hebrew, and all their thinking is no different than the Gentile in Stanford University. The Lo Aleinu, many of the Jews think that way. It's total non-Jewish thinking. He called it gentilized Israelis. And when Meir was in jail, he says, I'm quoting him, most painful of all of it is the knowledge that 90% of the prisoners are Sfardim from Yemen, Morocco, Iraq, Libya, all the countries where Jews kept the flame of Judaism alive despite the hostility of their Muslim neighbors. They are living proof of the tragic loss of Jewish identity in the Jewish state. They are the product of the secular Zionists who purported to save these primitive Jews who were still living in the Middle Ages. They succeeded in freeing them from their Jewish values in order to provide them with modern, enlightened values, the values of Dizengoff Street. Now they dream of money. The secular Zionists created a new Jew lacking Judaism. The irony is that this monster who despises Judaism went one step further and threw away Zionism. And what Meir says in this paragraph, absolutely no one can deny. This is reality. Ben Gurion, his generation, viewed the masses coming in from the Arab countries as backward, primitive, totally illiterate. And all the memoir literature describes what went on, and I don't have to repeat it. Kids were sent to kibbutzim. They took chickens and chopped off their heads by their hands. In Israel, you don't need a sheikhet. And totally took family after family and eradicated any trace of Shabbat, Kashrut, Tarat Mishpacha, etc. More than that, they re-educated. They took children from parents. All of you know, and this is unforgivable, how many kids disappeared from the Mabarat, from the tent encampments, and were given up for adoption. Many of these kids wound up in America. There was one, Harav Meshulam, remember, he died, he was put into jail, a Yemenite, this is in the 80s, we're yelling, screaming, everything he said was absolutely right. But people were still alive who could have been prosecuted, like Shimon Peres and others, and this is a tragedy that cries out to the heavens. And this was the mentality they had to eradicate. And ultimately, what you have, if you go over the world, and I have been in Sydney, I have been in Melbourne, I have been in Johannesburg, I've been in Cape Town, I've been all over Florida, all over California, etc., parts of New York, you see many of these Sfardim, you hear Hebrew all over the place. And ultimately, when you give up Judaism, a generation later, why do you need Zionism? The whole Eretz Yisrael is a result of Am Yisrael, the Eretz Yisrael, Al Pi Torah Yisrael. It's one package. when you give up part of the package, then sooner or later, more disappears. And here's where Kahana became very big. He was strong. He was dynamic. He yelled. He shouted. He fought the establishment. He had a lot of Sfadik following. More Sfadim voted for Kahana, infinitely more than the Ashkenazim. And this ultimately was his downfall. You all know what happened when he's elected to the Knesset, and 3 years later they're going to have another election. And the polls show Kahana coming in anywhere with 8 to 12 seats. And that's when they enacted the famous law that Kahana is a terrorist party, Kach, and it cannot be in the Knesset, he cannot run. And you can imagine this was going on while there were Arab parties, and there are Arab parties until today who cheer on the Palestinian Authority for pay for slay. The more Jews you kill, the more money you get. And these people are in the Knesset. But Kahana, they voted out of the Knesset. And this power, I can tell you one little story, Bididi Havi Uvda. We had years, I've said it more than once, and I don't deny it. The 70s into the 80s, after the Yom Kippur War, and Charlie, you should remember what happened to salaries and the loans and, you know, forced loans, whatever word you want to use. You had no choice in the matter. We were lucky to be alive. And these were very hard years. And we never ate out in a restaurant. Today I can eat in any restaurant I want, and I am so disappointed with restaurants. There's nothing like the food you make yourself at home. But okay. So I remember a couple very good friends, wonderful people, big supporters of Kahana. They may still have been living in America at the time. Ultimately, I brought these people in Aliyah. I take full credit. They've said it publicly. It's a whole drasha I gave. I won't go into it now. But that drasha ended their American stay. They heard me in Staten Island, that drasha. So these people said, we want to take you out, but before we go out to eat, we want to attend the rally for mayor. The rally was, I can tell you where, off the central bus terminal in that area, a little bit over to it. It was a hall, and the hall owner was a Sfadik guy, a supporter of Mayor Kahana, and he rented out the hall to him for a shekel or something. Hundreds of people. So I look around the crowd, and I want to go over to mayor, and here I am, after the talk, Ms. Mayer surrounded people looking at him like I would look at the Rav Mori Rebbe, as my grandchildren look at Rabbi Steinsaltz, if you remember my story. And I say, Mayer, two people jump on me. Asia Minsti Porza, Mayer, Harav Mayer, Mayitcha. Thank God Mayer turned around and saved my life. And these were hard-headed Sfardim. And Meir had them eating out of his hands. Now, in my humble opinion, and again, if people do research and do it honestly, I think to a certain degree, he paved the way for the success of Shas. Ultimately, what happens with Shas, and I have to tell you, Shas, it's beyond comprehension. Ari Derry goes to jail, Rav Ovadia dies, and Shas is quite powerful. Everyone, it's like Lander College, Truro. Everyone predicted when Rabbi Dr. Bernard Lander will pass on, Truro will disappear. Are you aware of that, Barak? Everyone predicted that. Truro is bigger than ever. It has less financial problems than YU. Same thing. Everyone predicted Shas would disappear. And Shas lives on. And part of it, I think, Meir, they saw, you need a strong leader. You have to work in the Knesset. You have to yell. You have to shout. And by the way, originally Shas used the ethnic card very strongly, if you recall. Today it's much less. I'll tell you why in a second. I think it's to their credit. But I think Meir coalesced Sfadik support around a strong personality and a religious personality. And I think Shas, and this you have to give Rav Avadya all the credit, we lived through the Black Panthers. Remember the early 70s, Haifa, what went on? But the Black Panthers, what do you mark?
Israeli Black Panthers?
No, they called themselves the Black Panthers here. It was a nickname given to them. But the Black Panthers, that's what they were popularly called in English at least. We lived through the riots and hatred for the Ashkenazim, hatred for the establishment. It was all negative. What Shas did, Labriyud, it added a positive structure. What did Rav Avadya say? L'hachzir atedet liyoshna. That caught on. It wasn't just the Ashkenazim put us down. All right, it began that way. It wasn't just we want to get even, that the blacks want to smack the white faces. It wasn't just that. It was much deeper. Ultimately, and you have to give Rav Avadya the credit, L'hachzir atedet liyoshna. And I have to say on a very personal level that in the Tzioni Dati world, the ethnic integration is absolutely total. I look at my own family, how much different blood there is, Moroccan, Libyan, Iraqi, Persian, and they don't even know. They look at me. I remember I spoke at one Pidgin Haben. The other grandmother had been my student in Mechala in the early 70s. She was the daughter of the Moroccan chief rabbi of Bar Akiva. Go and dream that later my grandson would marry her daughter. And this was she's a principal of a school. She's very capable. And her husband is a survivor, Czechoslovakian. I think he was born in a DP camp or he went through the hell, one of the two. And I spoke at the Pidgin Haben how much different blood there is in this kid, Moroccan, Czechoslovakian, Polish, Lithuanian, German, American, Canadian. And I could see my generation understood me very well. My grandchildren didn't even know what I'm talking about. We're all Israelis. And in the Tzioni Dati world, that has totally coalesced. I have to say also in Lubavitch, Rav Avadya Yosef had one brilliant son, the eldest son, Rav Avadya Yosef had one son. His name was Rav Yaakov Yosef. Unfortunately, he died young. A Talmud Chacham Mufak and a real Tzioni B'lev Nefesh. And I used to meet him at the Kotel every Friday night. And Rav Yaakov Yosef said, there are only two places in the world where there's no prejudice against Sfardim, among the Tzionim Datiyim and in Chabad. There's total integration. But Meir, in my humble opinion, played a little role in this evolvement. Had he run for the Knesset the second time, I don't know whether Shas would have come on the map, because he would have picked up so many Sfardic votes as the polls showed. But that was not to be. And then you all know, with all that Meir was yelling and shouting and doing, ultimately they forced him out of the Israeli scene. The last few years, he was a kol rei b'midbar. It's not being in the Knesset where you could go up and speak. Now, during all this time, Meir was appalled that the Jews from America didn't go in Aliyah. And one of the most fascinating incidents is 1976. In 1976, America celebrated its 200th anniversary. It was a big, big celebration. It was marred, of course, the bicentennial was marred, because that day all eyes were upon Israel. It was one of the really miraculous days of the 52 plus years I'm privileged to live on holy soil, That was Entebbe. Remember, July 4th, 1776. I actually had two students on the raiding party. Two BMT boys from the original years were on the raiding party. One was already a commander. The other one was a regular soldier. And what a day, what a memorable day that was. And but all over America, the Jews celebrated. The Orthodox shuls made a special service. The Rabbanim spoke about it. And Meir was furious. Quote, this is what he wrote in Jewish press. Torah in America, comfortable, satisfied, integrated. Eretz Yisrael is a nice place to visit, in which to study for a year, for which to demonstrate or give an activist sermon. But to live, there is only one place for the American Torah community. Our country, 200 years and ours, and the clock ticks on, and the fury prepares to pour out. Now, in this article in Jewish Press, and by the way, Jewish Press was the home for both Meir, you have to give them credit, and for Esther Jungreis, two people who operated outside the establishment, their own thing, their own story, their own game, and Jewish Press was their home. For Meir, it was very important. For many years, it was his only source of income, his articles in Jewish Press. And in that article, he criticized some of the Orthodox American hotbeds of communities, including Washington Heights. And he let the German Orthodox Jews have it. You have to understand, Washington Heights, the German Orthodox Jews, this is a unique anomaly. It's fascinating because here, Rav Shinshraful Hirsch was really way ahead of his time, Torah Umada. Machon Lev totally represents Rav Shinshraful Hirsch. All its founders were of German origins. And all his followers who came in Aliyah, they're the founders of Kibbutz Adati. Kibbutz Adati in its initial years was half Polish and half German. Torah v'derech Eretz became Torah v'avoda. In America, YU, it became Torah umada. But Rav Hirsch was ahead of his time. On the other hand, Rav Hirsch was not a Zionist. A lot has been written about this, but I don't know, it's very fair to criticize him because Rav Hirsch lived in the 19th century and he died in 1888, if I'm not mistaken. And he lived at a time when the real Zionism was not yet on the ground. It was a vague dream. But you see, many of the second generation, the third generation, including his own descendants, Rav Yitzchak, Dr. Yitzchak Breuer is a prime example. That's already a third generation. Then you go to the fourth generation, Rabbi Dr. Jacob Breuer, Rabbi Jacob Breuer, cousins. Wow, did they integrate on the Israeli scene. In America, to a certain degree, you had America, you were living in America, they were happy to be in America, they conquered Washington Heights, they remained outside the parameters of religious Zionism, and Meir Kahana let them have it. Do you know who answered him in print and an open letter to the community? The president of Kehillat Adat Yeshurun, Dr. Raphael Mala, who was married to the great-granddaughter of Rav Shinshraful Hirsch. He was the father-in-law of my Rebbe, Rav Yosef Weiss, and he let Meir have it. And Meir wrote back, typical Kahana, I love the Jews of Washington Heights as I do all other Jews. I love them so much that I promise them that I will give them no rest. I see a catastrophe coming, and I do not wish to see the children of a generation that died because it could not see following the paths of their fathers. What he's referring to, of course, is Hitler. And we all know that so many people died. They didn't run away. They didn't get out in time. Who could believe what Hitler would do? I don't want to see their descendants make the same mistake. We Jews have a destiny, listen carefully, to climb the mountain of Zion. Let us escape today from Washington depths and reach Zion's height. You follow? It's a play on words. Washington Heights to Zion's Heights. And this was Meir. Was he right? Was he wrong? I'll tell you, for many decades I felt he was wrong. It's one thing to call attention to problems, but the Jew was thriving in America, and Torah was surviving in America and starting to thrive. When I grew up, I told you, 700,000 Jews in the Bronx. I don't know if you had a minion of Shomrei Shabbos. Today, I need not tell you, the President of the United States can have grandchildren who are Shomrei Torah Mitzvah. It's a different world. I thought Meir was wrong. I'm not certain what's going on in America today. We have to reevaluate our thinking and see what happens. I always used to say that you come in Aliyah, Ahavat Mordechai. Today I have a feeling we have a bigger aliyah from America than ever according to the statistics, but it's not just Avat Mordechai, it's Sinat Haman. And on that level, Meir was right. I came not Sinat Haman, I came Avat Mordechai. Charlie, you came Avat Mordechai, no question about it. But today already, Meir has shaken the tree, the apples are starting to fall. Now, one, define everything I've said with one little story, then I want to end off this part of the lecture with a story in honor of Barak, about your family and my indebtedness to them. Okay? You're wondering? In a million years you'll never guess, but 10 minutes from now you'll say, Rebbe, fabulous. Thanks. You see, I love Meir. I think like Meir. I'm not the only one who thinks like Meir, as you will see later today, I hope, if not next week. A lot of great people think like Meir. But then you face practicality. How can you bring about these ideas in a practical fashion, in a real world? And here already, you have to make compromises. You have to work within the system. As I've said time and again for decades, I repeat myself, the minute we work outside the system and take the law into our own hands, we're destroying ourselves. Because each Jew thinks he knows it all. And you wind up, as my father said, if the Arabs were smart, let the Israelis alone, don't bother them, they'll wind up killing each other with all their inner fights. Okay. Got to work within the system. And I'll prove it to you. Down south, there was a Rosh Yeshiva who started the whole change of the southern community. By the way, his native language was English. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Rabbi Yisachar Meir was a Panovitcher. I believe he was born in England. Check it out, see his biography. But I know he knew English perfectly, and I think it was his first language. Rabbi Yisachar Meir, I yet met him when I came in Aliyah. He died in 2010. Very powerful figure, charismatic. And he ran a yeshiva trying to bring Panovich to a crowd that basically was religious Zionist. In other words, his original students were all from yeshiva Tichoniyot and much more open than the atmosphere he came from or the atmosphere he sought to create, although he made his compromises. So a biography came out about him in 2014 on his life. It was a very nice biography. And on page 206 in that biography, you read how a student came to Meir, this is in the 70s, 1970, right after the Six-Day War, and the student says to Harav Yisachar Meir, let's not mix up the two Meirs, let's use Harav Yisachar. A student came to Harav Yisachar, said, Rebbe, you know, I've learned here for a number of years, I know how to learn, I think it's time I should go into the army, I have to do my share. And Rav Yisachar says to him, you're right, you're a good student, you're a Talmud Chacham, you're Yirei Shamayim, and there is an obligation to help, to serve, but you won't get anywhere in the army. You're religious, and the army will not allow religious people to rise in rank to really make a contribution. It's not worth it. Keep in learning and make your contribution within the world of Torah. Now you turn to Meir Kahana. Meir Kahana has a younger brother, my age, my shevet, Bnei Akiva, Rav Nachman, rabbi of the Young Israel of the Old City. And he's much quieter than Meir. I'm sure he agrees with everything Meir says, but you have to do it in a fashion that it can succeed. And his son served in the army, a Yiddish tzaddik. His son married many children, rose to the rank of brigadier general. Okay? Tat aluf. Within the system. And he was interviewed many times. He didn't hide his point of view, but he said, look, in the army, I'm part of the system. I take orders. I give orders. It all has to be within the confines of what the army strives for, what the army expects out of you. But see, that kid in 1970, Rav Yisachar might have been right. You couldn't rise in the army at that time. Today, within the system, kippah are all over the place. I needn't apologize. If you make a survey of the Knesset, leaving out the Arab members, you'll find that the majority of Chavrei Knesset are Shomrei Shabbat 100% or very, very traditional, very Mesorati. So that's the pro, that's the con, that's Meir, that's his beliefs, his outlook. I share with you my feelings, and these problems we live with are real. We haven't totally solved them until today. But Baruch Hashem, when I look around Israel, when I look around the youth, we're on the right path. God should take us further. And here I want to tell a story that happened to me. And I'm including the story in Anya of Barak. When Meir died, there was a period which is fading away when I used to do a lot of traveling. At my age already, I'm happy to travel from my house to be to Gruss. People say, you still drive? I say, yeah, I drive three places. Gruss, Rami Levi, and Osherad. My car is automatic, and I only drive hours when there's not heavy traffic. All right, I have to give in. We go anywhere, my children take me. They're very good. My children, my grandchildren, they appreciate their grandfather. It's to be appreciated by your own family is an achievement, because I wasn't the best father. I was busy and busy. But Baruch Hashem, always busy with Torah, nothing else. So I happened to come to America that Sunday when Meir was assassinated. I had to speak. It involved Russian Jewry, whatever. We're having a parlor meeting and a number of meetings and foundations. And they needed me in person. Fine. I went to sleep. I was very tired. I took the midnight flight out of Israel, arrived Sunday morning in New York. And I remember I stayed in a wonderful home, people who we were very close to, the Kabik House, Zichronim Tzadikim Levracha, world-class medical doctor, totally devoted to Torah, to Russian Jewry. And Seal woke me up. She said, Aaron, Mayer was assassinated. He was assassinated a 10-minute walk from where I was staying in Manhattan. Okay, that Shabbat I was gone in residence in Woodmere at the Young Israel. And, what a crowd was there. And I'm ready to speak. And I told the rabbi in advance, a wonderful rabbi, Rabbi Hirsch, Billick, right? Yeah, Rabbi Billick, Heshi Billick. I'm started to think about Billet with a T, and Billet was the family I knew from Newark that lives here. Correct. Billet, Rabbi Hirschel Billet, his wife had been my student, my first class in Michlalar, actually, in 71, a postgraduate class. And I said, I'm going to have to speak about Meir Kahana. And boy, he got all frightened what I would say. I mean, Meir was assassinated that week. That week was his funeral. And I tied it into the Pasha. I'm not a bad Dashan. I can, a Dashanut is the ability to take anything in the world and find it in the Pasha. I've given lectures on this. There's a big difference between Musar and Sermonics. So he gets up before he says to me, Rabbaran, he says, before you speak, I have to make a disclaimer so people won't hold me responsible for what you're saying. All right. I'm not arguing with him. I'm a big boy already. At my age, you can yell at me, joke with me, make fun of me, do whatever you want. I look up. I don't look any other way. So he gets up and he says, we have the honor this morning, Rabbi Dr. Aaron Rakefet will be addressing us, and as you know, he grew up in Bnei Akiva, Meir Kahana was his madrich, and he is going to speak about Meir. And I'm not a fan of Meir, and I just want you to know it's his opinion, it doesn't necessarily affect me other show. So I get up and speak. I didn't even know what I spoke about. I have to find my notes someplace. I probably have them. And the place was spellbound. And I finish. And before I can come off the pulpit, one of the most important rabbis in that greater community who had come to hear me runs up and in front of hundreds of people kisses me and hugs me right in front of the Aron Kodesh. You know what his name was? Rabbi Binyamin Kamenetsky. Got it? Did you guess who it was? Okay. So I want to thank you and your family. I was very close, of course, to other members of the family, but I'll never forget that. Hugged me and kissed me in front of everyone. That was a statement. Kol hakavod. Anyone under 18, please leave the room. Now, let's go a little bit deeper and understand what Meir Kahana was about, why there was so much opposition. Was the opposition justified? What happened in modern times, meaning in the last few years? Let me try to explain, and let me be as honest as I can, although there's a subjective overtone. Time will tell if I'm totally right or only partially. One of the lessons you learn in life, they once asked Rabbaran Lichtenstein, what did you learn in Harvard? And Rabbaran, I trust you know who Rabbaran was, right? I mean, this kollel is a fragment of what it was without Rabbaran. And I personally, every day, I miss him. He was the one person I felt totally comfortable with consulting with, discussing a halachic problem, a philosophic problem, a hashkafic problem, etc. Not that we agreed in everything, but Rabbaran, I know from 51 on, he was a gadol shebegadolim and a tzaddik shebetzaddikim. And, in life there's what you see and there's what's the undertone. Now, a volume just came out, The Rabbi of Buchenwald, The Life and Times of Heschel Schachter. Again, the minute you mention the name Heschel Schachter, people will immediately think, who do you mean? Rav Heschel, the Rosh Yeshiva. Rav Heschel, the Rosh Yeshiva, we grew up together. We grew up together. He's younger than I am. He's about 2 years younger than I am. But there was an elder rabbi, Rabbi Heschel Schachter, the father of the famous Rabbi Dr. Yaakov Yosef, Yankele Yosef, J.J. Schachter, Professor Schachter. The elder Rabbi Schachter was a very prominent rabbi. He was rabbi in Connecticut and Stamford, Connecticut, and volunteered very early in World War II, went in as a chaplain to the American Army. He was the rabbi of the forces that liberated Buchenwald. And then he came back. By that time, Stamford, Connecticut had another rabbi, Rabbi Ehrenkranz, and they were happy with Rabbi Ehrenkranz. Rabbi Ehrenkranz was supposed to be only temporary, but he remained there for life, and Rabbi Schachter was placed in Marshall Loop Parkway in the Bronx, where he remained for life. Ultimately, Marshall Loop Parkway, the Bronx disappeared, Jews disappeared, all that's left in the Bronx today is basically Riverdale. And Rabbi Schachter had a very fine rabbinate, a very fine reputation, and became very active on the rabbinical council, and ultimately when Soviet Jewry became an issue, he became very active, and ultimately the president of the American Conference on Soviet Jewry, he visited Russia, he what a personality, his native language, Yiddish, was a fabulous speaker, both in Yiddish and English, etc. Now, in 1971, a conference was called in Brussels. By 1970, the Soviet Jewry movement had picked up tremendous momentum. Before the 60s, very few people heard about Soviet Jewry. Kahana started it. And then slowly but surely, the student struggle for Soviet SSJ, and a New York committee, a New York conference, a Washington conference, a Philadelphia, a national committee, a Long Island committee, and finally, and this was going on in America, was going on in England, going on in Australia, Izzy Leibler, tremendous activist, very well-to-do, and put his money where his heart is, and the Australian government went out of its way to accommodate Izzy Leibler and to help with Soviet Jewry. I write about it from my vantage point in Washington, what I saw in 89. Sir Shlomo Michael, Solomon Michaels Center. And in 71, they decided to hold a conference in Brussels, in Belgium, an area that was accessible. Europe, Australia had to come up, America had to come down, everyone could meet there, Jews in England, France, etc., Germany, everyone yelling, shouting, let my people go, shalach et ami. And I want to thank Rabbi Grunstein. He sent me, before, I haven't seen the book. The book should be brought to me today. I'll go downstairs after class, and I hope to have it. And I thank Rabbi Grunstein. He sent me the pages, and he was in a state of shock. I'll tell you what happened. Mayor Kahana came to Brussels, uninvited. And Rabbi Schachter, who was chairing this whole event, an historic event, Jews from all over the world getting together, and getting together for one purpose, let my people go. And remember, they're putting pressure on Russia, and Russia was subject to pressure because Russia was a very poor country. It's something no one recognized. We thought Sputnik, they're powerful, they're this, yeah. They invested money in the army, they invested money in Sputnik, in going around the world, going to the moon, etc. But people were living on next to nothing, apartments shared. Yeah, they boasted everyone in Russia has an apartment. Yes, you had, I saw with my own eyes. You had one room, another family had one room, and you shared a kitchen and a bathroom. And that was good already. Sometimes there were three families in one apartment. And the food, negligible. The standard of living, who dreamt of owning a car? Outside of members of the Politburo. And Russia was susceptible to pressure. They needed hard currency, etc. And Mayor Kahana comes, and they refuse to let him speak. More than that, and Rabbi Grinstein, my dear student, son of a student, Tzvi, Zichrona Levracha, you remember his father? It was in BMT, your time. And they went as, my student was in a state of shock. Rabbi Schechter called the police. Arrest this man. He's disturbing the conference. We didn't invite him. And they took Mayer into custody. After a day or two, they let him out. They were smart enough to know why get involved with the Jews killing each other. Zones like the Hagen and Ainid, the Andera, and let us rest in peace with our anti-Semitism. Why should we get involved? But arrest this man. What are we talking about? Okay, let me explain to you. And all this material I'm telling you, you'll see in the book on Rabbi Schechter. But the interpretation, you have to understand what went on and read between the lines. And now let me fill you in on something else. And I'll explain it all. I write about this in what I'm preparing for publication. I've alluded to it in the past. Before 2002, I couldn't speak about it. Now I can tell. Very fascinating. Once a week or once every 10 days, I would disappear. I would disappear. Classes were called off. Rakefitz in the army. I was in the army. I gave a lecture in Tel Aviv in the Central Army Command Base, had lunch, treated like a king. The girls who ran the kitchen and the officers were all Eidot HaMizrach, and their love and respect for Torah was indescribable. Okay? Treated like a king. And then I would walk across the street, 2-3 blocks away, from the Central Army Command, Rehov Albert Mendler, which doesn't exist today, Sirona knocked it all out, and I'd get into the Center for Russian Jewry. It only took, to get into the army base, one security check. To get in for the center, 3 security checks. And I told you why, because the house I had to go to had one of the few computers operating in Israel. It was an entire wall. The name of every refusnik, the name of everyone who wanted to get out, who they had to establish families for, etc., etc. 3 different levels. All right, now I get in. And whatever we had to do, we did. I would meet with the boss. We never used his name because of fear that when he would travel, the KGB knew we was, but he never stayed in the same hotel 2 straight nights. We later found out with the fall of the Soviet Union, they knew who he was exactly, and they watched him very closely, whatever he did. They knew what was going on. But as I write in Washington, there were reasons why they had to allow me into the country. It had to do with this. Read Washington, you'll understand. So the boss says to me, Harav Rakefet, yesh li mishima bishvilcha. I'm looking at here, what's going on? He says, okay, by 19, I give you the exact date in the new article and what I have prepared. It's a while till publication. Something else will be published first, but this is major, but it's in manuscript already. So by the mid-80s, everyone was demonstrating for Russian Jewry. Now, B'nai Brak, the Haredi world, they react last. Their attitude is, we know what we have, we don't know what we're going to get. They're in no rush to go anywhere. But by the mid-80s, because of what was going on, people already knew that their Jews in Russia being Maisa Nefesh for Yiddishkeit, for Shabbat, for Kashrut, for Taret Mishpacha, families, one family in Vilna traveled by plane once a month to go to mikveh to Moscow, an entire day going, mikveh, coming back, Shabbat, Kashrut. Oh, what was going on? So some of the people in B'nai Brak said, Lomani Gara, we also have to demonstrate. So they got in touch with the Mossad. Everyone knew there's a branch that deals with Russian Jewry. And Rafal Halperin, you know what I'm talking about? Rafal Halperin, one of the, if you don't know, go to Wikipedia. Halperin Glasses, what he established, the chain, Rafal Halperin, who established B'nai Brak? It was his father, Yaakov Halperin. He's an einikel of the Dorot HaRishonim. That's the family, very close to the Chazon Ish. And Rafal was a Chevron student, was a wrestler in my youth. He came to America, he wrestled with a Mug and David on his trunks. Ach, were we impressed with him. And a very wealthy businessman. And he contacted the Mossad. He wants to organize a demonstration. So the boss said to me, we want you to work with him. You're our official representative. And you know all our rules and regulations. You tell him what to do. But above all, stress to him, we do not criticize the Russian government. We do not criticize communism. We stress one idea. Let my people go. Reparations. Let them rejoin. Let the families be united. Let the Jews come back to their national homeland, their indigenous homeland. Soviet law permits it. And what are we dealing with here? See, this is a sophisticated approach. This is looking at the total picture. What will accomplish? What will not accomplish? How do we get to the Soviet non-Jewish communist heart? And in their rules and regulations, there were Germans who they repatriated after World War II. This is their national, natural homeland. They don't belong here. They understood that. And this was the point that we have to stress. Now, it could be in our hearts, we hated the communists. We hated the Russians. Killers, murderers, Stalin, Lenin, death camps, Siberia, Eder Nudel. But that's not going to help. Positive, not negative. I'll go one step further. I have to come back now to Brussels, but just to end off this little introduction, Mark will say, Rebbe, so what happened with Rafal Halperin? What happened with Rafal Halperin? One of the greatest embarrassments ever in my life. I shudder. I wrote an 100-page article now dealing with this embarrassment. What happened was very simple. Rafal Halperin, you never man like him. He took me out to his, he had two restaurants. Do you remember Milchig, when you barely had a place on Dizengoff to eat, kosher? He had meat, milk, both glatt kosher. That was, what an individual. We start planning, and he understood the minute. I said, this is the main concept that you must get across, not to curse, not to maledict, not to be critical, positive. The word went out that we're planning this demonstration. Forget about the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Lubavitcher Rebbe always was opposed to demonstrations. Shtadlanut. They brought Rabbi Teitz in from America, Chas v'chalila, to demonstrate you'll offend the Russian government. It'll harm Jews. There'll be more Asirei Tzion, more people in Siberia, Chas v'chalila. And this raises the whole issue. Did we do the right thing by being silent in the late 30s? Or should we have yelled and shouted against Hitler? What did Mori Rebbe have you? Do you know Rakepit's two volumes on the Rav by heart yet, Barak? Not yet. You better get there soon so you know how to breathe air properly. What did the Rav say? We have to air our Al-Chet, Al-Chet Sheshemanu et Kol Tzakat Achenu Be'erapa V'lo Asinu Maspik V'lo Asinu Dai. And that's word by word from the Rav. I'm translating to English, but I heard it in Hebrew. They canceled. And by the mid-80s, it was obvious that the demonstrations were cracking holes in the Iron Curtain. Maybe there's a time not to demonstrate, but by the mid-80s, anyone who sat on top of the information, there's only one conclusion, yell, shout, positive reparation, let them come home. Now, come back to Brussels. The establishment took their orders from Tel Aviv. That's why I said to you, I hope I said it, if not I'm saying it now, I guarantee you, I told Rabbi Grunstein that I am positive. There are no sources. I'm positive. On a rational basis, Rabbi Schechter and his cohorts called Tel Aviv. For all I know, the boss, Aryeh Kroll himself, I know what he thought of Kahana. Arrest him! Get rid of him! Call the police! More than that, the establishment right in Brussels, and this you'll find in the article, had a terrible dilemma. The Russians, the activists in Russia, the activists who have gotten out, they were furious. They spoke. They were represented at the conference. You can't keep a Russian out. These people got out. They were hysterical. Here, Schechter spoke. This one's from, what did they say? We praise the great Russian Empire. We praise their army. They liberated us. They saved us in World War II. They helped the Allies defeat the Nazis, Yamach Shmam. And you had the nerve to get up and say, we praise the Russian army and talk like this? That Russian army, that KGB, that communist attitude, they killed Jews. They sentenced Jews to Siberia. They pulled them out of the shoes. They lose their work ability. They are sent into refusal. They are turned into second-rate citizens. No one will hire them. And you have the chutzpah to praise the Russian army? And these people worship the ground that Meir Kahana walked on. What did Rakefit show you last week? The picture of Bilyovsky? Meir Kahana sticking out of his pocket in Leningrad, 1985. I took the picture. It's not a piece of work from the computer. It's the real picture. Do you see the conflict here? Do you see what we're up against? Who is right? I don't know. They're both right. But on the public thoroughfare, knowing as much as I knew and seeing what went on in the office in Tel Aviv, I sided with the anti-Kahana people. You can't yell, you can't shout. You have to praise, you have to fawn over them. there's a reason why. But this is not public. You can't make this public. This mayor came, the rush, you should see, the Russian activists were furious that they didn't let mayor speak. But you have here Dinei Nefashot. Who is right? Who is wrong? Ultimately, communism fell, disappeared almost overnight. But do you crack the wall? Do you put them down? Do you quote every sin they did in public? Or do you take the good they did and praise it to the sky? And I have to tell you, you know, there was a big difference. I don't know if you're aware of it, but when you read the memoir literature, the Allies, the Americans were coming on one end, the Russians were coming on the other end. The Germans prayed that they be conquered by the Americans, not the Russians. The Russians killed everyone in sight. Every German, everyone with the... They took off their uniforms so quickly. The Nazi soldiers disappeared. They were... I know Ivan Gluck, my dear friend, who was liberated in Budapest. He was in a safe house. And the last day of the war, the Germans in a safe house had consulate dignity or consular being watched or status, whatever word you want to use, diplomatic status. They started killing Jews. They killed one Jew and they're ready to shoot the next. And at that moment, the Russians broke in and they killed every German soldier in sight. No questions asked. So you see, there's something to be thankful for. Well, absolutely. But you have to know how to approach it. Both have truth. And this is the story behind the scenes. And it's fascinating in the volume on Rabbi Schachter. They tell you about Mayer and coming and those who said he should speak and shouldn't speak and the Russian activist and the yelling and the shouting and how dare you praise. But put the dots together, connect it, and you get a full picture. And this is exactly what with the Fall Halperin, I'll never forget. Aye said to me, Tazbilo, Klau Besisi Shatamakir. And how to approach it. And I understand. I understand. I feel for Mayer. I feel for the Russian activists. And I have to tell you, time and again this issue came up. I remember in 1981, one of my missions, you know, before you left, they briefed you. It was 85. I'd have to check my records. So there was a big activist in Leningrad, Gorodetsky. I don't know. I haven't heard the name recently. Yomo. No, let him sleep. Okay. Gorodetsky. Yakov Gorodetsky. And one of my assignments was to explain to Gorodetsky, cut down your criticism of Israel. They don't do enough. They don't help enough. You don't know what we're doing, but we can't talk about it. And you got to keep it quiet. And you can't, if you criticize the government in public, you make it harder for us to operate within the Soviet Union. And he, you know, his criticisms, some of them were legitimate. But you have to understand the total picture. Okay, so this is one basic point I wanted to make. I have another very major point to make. There it is. Baruch ato Adonai Melech Olam Shehakol Niyeh B'Dvaro. This is a file from my office. It reads the Herzog file. What happened was a number of years ago, maybe it's 5 years already, Rabbi Sasson is listening, he'll give you the date. They opened up in Israel their archives, and archives are not available to the public. There are reasons why, because people are alive yet, people will be embarrassed, issues are ongoing. But like 50 years later, now they're opening up the archives of the Yom Kippur War. You've read about it in the weekend papers. So 50, 60 years later, you know, you're not going to do any harm by opening the archives. Sorry, they go through it. There's certain things that are security they have to, they cannot yet open. I can understand that. I know that one of my other security clauses, I know information that I'll never be able to reveal. I would imagine. It'll be, if I can reveal it, there'll be peace on earth. That's all I can say. But until then, I can't reveal it. So I can understand that. But not everything is so sensitive. So they opened up the Herzog files. Herzog files, we're talking about President Chaim Herzog, who was a general in the army and president of the State of Israel. One of the most fascinating documents found in his files was a letter from the Rav, a handwritten letter to Herzog, criticizing Herzog when the Kahana was elected to the Knesset, talking early 80s. So the president interviews all the different parties and ahead of deciding who should be asked to form the government. This is the way Israel works. It's a different system than America. It's like the German system. The German parliament now faces trying to put together a government where no party has a real landslide, a real majority, a real plurality, I think is the right word. And President Herzog, Chaim Herzog, refused to interview Meir Kahana. And the Arab murderers he interviewed, you should see the letter, a very strong letter written by hand. I mean, all right, you can go online, I have it all here, but I can't start to take it apart and show it to you. It's a world. And rebuking Herzog 1,000%. Excuse me? The letter is in Hebrew. In Hebrew. Yeah, here it is. Here's the letter. Letters in Hebrew. Yeshiva University Stationery, Nitkabel, Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik. I have the letter. Here it is. It's right in front of me. And I was so happy, you know, when this letter surfaced. My student in America found it in the archives. You have to go through the archives. There's all the material from the archives on many different topics, but of things that are of interest to me. And I was going to publish it in Rakefer Aaron Chelik Dalet. However, it became clear to me, and later, this is from the Sfarim blog, you can find a lot of information about it, a forged letter. This is by Moshe Lichtenstein, the Rav's grandson. The letter was written when the Rav already wasn't totally functioning. The Rav was dependent upon his gabayim. So when I saw the letter the first time, it was clear to me that it's not the Rav's handwriting, but he probably dictated it. It's not the Rav's Hebrew either. It's not on the level. The Rav's Hebrew is way above this letter. This letter is an American kid who is writing Hebrew and listening to his Rebbe, at least I thought. The problem then begins with the signature, that it's not the way the Rav would sign a letter. The letter is signed Yosef Dov Ben La'aba Murray Rebbe Moshe Halevi Soloveitchik Ish Boston. First of all, Yosef Dov is without a Vav. The Rav never signed with a Vav. Here there's a Vav. Secondly, he never mentioned his father's name except when he signed the Smicha. So the family, and this is Moshe Lichtenstein, wrote a long article which was published in the Sfarim website. The letter is not accurate. It's someone who had access to the Rav, to the YU stationery, someone who knew the Rav obviously, and wrote this letter to Kahana. What's fascinating is in the Herzog, wrote this letter to President Herzog about Kahana. Thank you. What's fascinating is that in the Herzog archives, There's a copy of President Herzog's answer to the Rav, and Herzog took the letter seriously. L'chvod Maran, he writes to the Rav, and in his letter he states that what he couldn't say publicly is that we have information: the more Kahana yells and shouts, the more Jews are persecuted, even endangerment to life in the Arab countries. There's still Jews in every Arab country, and if you let the fires burn, they can burn fires too. And he says, I'd be willing to interview Kahana and meet with him, but only if he backs off on his violence against Arabs. So you see right away, there's more than meets the surface. Well, this issue went on for at least a year. Is the letter accurate? Isn't it accurate? And I was asked the question 1,000 times over. And I said, as much as I would love that letter to be accurate, I have to conclude it's not the Rav. I have an idea who it might have been. I didn't live in America at that time. You understand, I'm gone since 69. But I know what's going on in yeshiva. I have my own theory, but I don't even want to mention it because the person died young. The person never married. The person was a kanoi, no question about it. But if we don't have proof, let's not mention it. The question that hangs fire is what happened to the letter that President Herzog sent to the Rav. In other words, there has to be a letter in Washington Heights that the Rav received. No one but no one has ever found that letter. So that's also a fascinating part of the puzzle. But let's take the underlying theme. Could the Rav had ever written a letter defending Kahana? And there the answer is absolutely no. You can check the commentator. When at times students wanted to bring Kahana to the yeshiva, the minute they would ask the Rav, he would be totally opposed. And what you see, that this concept, what's our relationship to Kahana, it's a tremendous machloket, a tremendous chasm between two brothers, Moyer Rebbe HaRav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik and his younger brother, my dear friend, don't want to say colleague, but I'm a Talmud Chaver of his, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. And in an article that appeared, I think this article appeared in Jewish press, it's in honor of Rabbi Kahana's 26th Yahrzeit, Let the Truth Be Told, by Rabbi Shlomo Maria, November 18th, 2016. And in this article, 36 admirers of Rabbi Meir Kahana. And he quotes, I'm quoted in here, but I'm the least of what they quote. The Rabbi Tavter, you read it, you find. But they quote Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik word by word, quote, Rosh Yeshiva Brisk stated what Rabbi Kahana said was absolutely correct. Just we don't say it because the world will criticize us. But someone had to say it. And you see, here too, fascinating dialogue between two brothers. And I'll share with you my insight. I might be right, I might be wrong. Where did the Rav spend his formative years? No, White Russia, Poland. He grew up among the Goyim. He grew up among anti-Semitism. He saw the communist takeover of Haslovich. Quote what I have in my work on the Rav, word by word, where he describes what happened in 1918, 1919. The Rav, very frightened, my Yomru Hagayim, Kahana racked the boat, too loud, too honest. It's not the way you speak in public. Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, where'd he grow up? Washington Heights. Came to America 13 years old. Saw very little, or understood very little. As a kid, formative years, United States, Talmudical Academy, Yeshiva College, Metifta Rab Chaim Berlin. Rav Aaron, he was afraid of no one. Here already, freedom, state what's on your mind. Mea Kahana, every word is true, honest. All right, sometimes we can't say it publicly, but someone had to say it, and that was Mea. Very fascinating, the chasm, dichotomy between them. It shows, you know what else it shows, Charlie? 1960s, Vietnam. Do you remember what went on? Rav Aaron, totally opposed to American involvement, spoke his mind, took a position. The Rav, no, you don't criticize the government. The government knows what it's doing. Don't get out, you criticize, it'll affect Israel. They'll say no involvement with Israel too, don't help Israel. The Rav, don't rock the boat. Rav Aaron, wow. And this may very well affect and explain their attitude towards Meir. And that's why when the letter was found, someone like myself rejoiced. Wow, my Rebbe sees through Rav Meir and basically understands the good in Rav Meir. But others said, it cannot be. This is the Rav, and he wouldn't allow Meir to speak, and he spoke against, and he's too extreme, and all that goes with it. And this is the dichotomy. All right. I hope I've done justice to Meir's memory. As I've said more than once, that family paid a very heavy price. Mayor Nachman Kahana said to me more than once, he said to me, Aaron, he said, everyone knew my brother would be assassinated. We just didn't know the date. And there's depth to that too. Because Mayor's viewpoint, public position, it engendered animosity on the other side. And Very sad. Very sad what happened afterwards, how America looked at it. Ah, it's just Meir Kahana. And you all know afterwards, the Twin Towers, one time, then 9/11, and it all went back to the same people who brought Meir down, lo aleinu. Afterwards, Binyamin Zev, his son, his daughter, here with our terrorism, the price we have paid. I'm reading now a very fascinating volume on the children of Rav Meisha Horowitz, my students Ellie and Dina, killed in Kir Daba, a volume written by their daughter, the granddaughter of Rav Meisha Horowitz, Leah Horowitz, and it brings back all the memories of how BMT began. And I hope we'll have a 50th anniversary for that class and do something and say something in their memory. Barak, they changed the course of Anglo-Torah history. You're sitting here and Shlomo's sitting here because of BMT 1969. Rabbi Meisha Horowitz, the first dean, and the crooked nose you're looking at, the only survivor of the original faculty. Gotcha. I have so much more to teach. I need many more years. Can't look at my age. Can't look at my age. Still driving. Only three places, but still driving, teaching, learning, writing, being mechadesh. A long way from the Rabbi Rothkopf that Charlie heard about in the halls of MTA. Am I right or wrong? You knew I existed?
I can't remember that.
Very rare. What years were you there?
57 to 62.
So you, what, 1 second. You graduated, so you graduated before I started teaching. I started teaching September 62.
I graduated in June 62.
So how should you know? Yeah, of course you don't remember my name. It's the president of Machon Lev. He says to me, "Och, I remember you, Rabbi Rothkopf, your students used to talk about you." The vice president is my student, Stewie Hershkowitz. The president knows me when I was yet a Rebbe in the halls of YU and the academic center, as it was called. Ah, you really are an old timer. Graduated before my time. So 1 second, I graduated high school 55. You graduated 62. So there's 7 years between us. Oh, at our age, this is garnish chain. What can we do? Okay. My dear students, I want to thank you all for honoring me with your presence. It's wonderful to have students in front of me again. And we should just have good news. We all grow older. Some of my students are not that well anymore. And we lost two of our students. Well, they were, you know, well into their 90s, but we lost two great individuals. Joey Abelo and Professor Sal Green. Okay, but anyone else who's not in the best of health should have a total refuah shleima l'kavod u'l'tiferet. What did we do today? All right, we finished at Mei Kahana. We dealt with the Svadim, dealt with Shas. Again, my theories may be right, my theories may be wrong, but I have a good chush that if I'm wrong, I'm not entirely wrong, that's for sure. We dealt with the Brussels. That's a very important chapter. And read the book and read, and then read it again with the understanding I gave you, and you'll see I hit the nail on the head. And believe me, they called the police. Tel Aviv told them, call the police, get rid of him. He'll undermine everything. And on the other hand, the Russian activist who got out, he's right. How dare you praise? Read word by word what I'm saying is what the Russian activists are quoted in Brussels. The story of the letter and the Rav and Rabaron Soloveitchik, that's fascinating. That we lived, it's all over the internet. There's no question in my mind the letter is a forgery. And I couldn't publish it. I was going to publish it in Rakafet Aaron, you know, with the background, with the translation, etc. But it's a forgery. What bothers me is what happened to the letter Chaim Herzog sent. So it shows you the person who wrote the original letter had access to the Rav's mail, and they took it away. And Elliot, you don't know how much I researched. I contacted all the Gabbayim of that period. One of them I reached in summer camp. Rebbe, how did you know where to reach me? I said, all right, I'm a good detective at times. And all of them claimed they had no knowledge of the letter. But all right, my theory is my theory. I don't want to say a word publicly. The person had a very hard life. Yosef Halevi Soloveitchik, the son of Rabaron, I think on his yahrzeit always does something in his memory. He says, at least let him be remembered. No one is around that can a descendant of his. All right, are there any questions on this end? I want to thank you very much until we meet again in health and happiness. Das Vidanya. And now open it to the world. What are they doing outside, all that noise? Okay, unmute. Are there any questions from around the world?
You mentioned repair.
Right.
About having somebody, if they can't be totally Shomer Shabbos, to try to do something.
Not to smoke.
The children.
Right.
I'm not, sorry?
No, Rasaraf Perrin is in the memoir about him, how he would be happy if some of these Mechallelei Shabbos didn't smoke on Shabbos.
Exactly. There was a story that my grandfather had a friend who had to work on Shabbos. And he told my grandfather he would come to shul Friday night, but he would say he couldn't say b'shamro. He wouldn't say b'shamro because he couldn't do it. And my grandfather said to him, you say it, and then as soon as you can, you do the best you can. And the same idea. Don't give up saying it.
All right, the story with the South Africa is very interesting. By the way, they claim the Chafetz Chaim also said Efshikem Malamet Zchut sign on the Jews in America that it's Pikuach Nefesh after work Shabbos. That's what I've heard claimed. But all right,
but he said you do it as soon as you're able to. You don't work.
No, but I understand.
But you don't give up on it because
but,
it is just.
Yeah, but what happened in America was a total abrogation of Shabbat, and it was a different world. The world was able to change when they gave up working on Saturday. Saturday, when I was growing up, Saturday was a half day work, and I told you many times if I had a hard Gemara that I didn't understand, I would go to my neighbor who came home at 1 o'clock, made Kiddush, had a Sudat Shabbat, and started learning Gemara with me. And Nebuch, that was the situation.
Rabbi Erlinger, who's just Niftar, you mentioned...
Right.
You mentioned that in one of the obituaries, it said he was one of the first Talmidim of Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik.
Right.
I'm not sure if
it means Reb Beryl. It means the Brisker Rav's son. Am I right, Charlie? It can't be he learned with the Rav. No.
But usually Reb Beryl, they call Reb Beryl.
I saw it too. I saw it. Yeshiva World News you're referring to. That's where I saw it, if I'm not mistaken.
I think I saw it on Matzav. Also, the concept of Avat Mordechai versus Sinat Amat. I've heard it described as the idea of why does the tefillah say Tikah b'shofar gadol? The shofar gadol that we should come to Eretz Israel because we want to do it positively, not because we're chased after.
Okay, it's the same thought, but I love to use Avat Mordechai and Sinat Haman. All right, I have some freebies. Are there any more questions? I have some freebies. Does anyone want, this is one of the latest issues of tradition. Pass it down. Yeah?
If it's possible to ask you a question, the synagogue in London.
Yeah, synagogue in.
What do you think of that?
No. I'm going to talk about it in a minute. Hold on, Rabbi Rubin. 1 second. Does anyone want the yeshiva and seminary guide? Vic, do you want it? Vic Snow. Do me a favor,
yeah.
Elliot, can you bring it to him? Because I know he has relatives. He asked me two years ago, the last time they published it. I want to tell you that Mark was right. 1 second. He sent me pictures of here. It's hard to see it, but pictures here, Stripes tea crackers, kosher lepesa, with a hey, not a chet. The problem we had yesterday, and here's another, here you see it even clearer. And I can tell you the best story is, I saw a picture of a grave in Africa. Some Jew died, and they buried him, and his widow, I don't think she was Jewish, but she said, put some Jewish writing on it that they should know he was Jewish. And I saw the picture of the monument. They took a box from Israel, and they copied over on his monument, Kosher LePesach. And on the monument that has his name and everything, Kosher LePesach. Now, what Rabbi Rubin asked, what he's referring to, is this transgender story happened in Liverpool, not in London, and it's all over the internet. If I understand the story correctly, they on Yom Tov Hasheni, they only had 9 people for a minyan. And there was one lady in the women's section who had undergone an operation to become from a man to a woman. So the rabbi Paskin And this is a Talmud Chacham Paskin that you can count it for the minyan. And he didn't insist she come into the man section because he didn't want to offend her, but he counted up for the minyan and she's fine. Al-Pi Halacha, he's absolutely right. And here I turn to Jack and I want to remind him. Jack once told me the following story, that this fellow from Toronto came, learned in the Gush, I believe it was, and he would happen for Shabbos, and a fine young man, fine individual. A few years later, he came back to visit Israel, visited Jack, and he walks in, a woman in a dress, he underwent. So I said to Jack, did you ask him if he put on tefillin? He's obligated to put on tefillin. It's like they say, Rabbi Chalap asked Cardinal Lustiger, when the Cardinal of Paris visited Yeshiva University, he asked him, did he put on tefillin that morning? Cardinal Lustiger, all his relatives are Shomer Torah mitzvah. There's a very famous Lustiger, Rabbi Dr. Arnold Lustiger in America. That's a cousin. They're cousins here in Israel, in Jerusalem. All Shomer mitzvah. He got caught up in the Holocaust. They gave him to a convent to raise him, and he became a cardinal. A Jew becomes a Catholic. It's not just stomach Catholic. He became a cardinal. And he has to put on tefillin. All right, Jack, do I have the story right? I think he's saying...
And his cousin's the Kaddish. His cousin's the Kaddish at his funeral.
Right, I know. He asked that they say Kaddish. Jack, what do you say?
You know that Michael Wishigrad, in one of his writings, wrote a letter to Lustiger telling him that he may believe in Jesus if he does, but he still has to put on tefillin.
Oh, very good. That's exactly what I said to Jack, that he put on tefillin that morning.
Close enough.
Rabbi, close. I can give you one more in addition to the graphics that I sent you with the misspellings. If you had asked the typical person what you say when Eliyahu HaNavi comes in at the Seder, they would say Shema Chamas Ba'ahagoy.
Right.
Now, it turns out we say Shema El-Hagoyim. It's a good example of actually differences between Kabbalah and Emet with longer psukim and Kabbalah. But the one that we say is in Tehillim, which is Shvach Hamat La'Elgoyim Ha'amam La'Hodah Yerush Kol Gavra'u Silav Stah. Then another Tiachalat Yaakov Bet Nave Le'Sham. The Pasuk in Yirmiyahu is Shvach Hamat La'Elgoyim Ha'am Shvach Hodah Yerush Kol Karal, adding Yachalat Yaakov, Vachalu Vayachalu Vet Nevei Lasham.
So
I saw a Ka'ara, a Seder plate somewhere, from 700 years ago, that started one Pasuk and ended the other one.
So you think that might have been...
I don't remember how it was. It probably started out a goyim.
It may have... So it could have been on purpose. I want to show you what shows up on the internet. This was sent to me. I can't believe it. I went to Yeshiva Salanta. Salanta began in Harlem 103, 104 years ago. It later moved to the Bronx. When I was growing up, it was the only yeshiva in the Bronx. It was called the Yeshiva Parochial School. For me, it was a miracle. And Nachum Lem, you're only sitting here because of the same miracle, that the yeshiva was about five little blocks from where I grew up and from where your father grew up. And here, the offices and board of directors of Talmud Torah, Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, 74 East, 118th Street, New York. In other words, this is when it was still in Harlem. And the president's name was Mr. Tights. So I don't know, very interesting. I see a Bornstein here, a Dennis, a Marx, a Rosenberg. Wow, that I teach people from these families, the board of directors. What's fascinating, I see only one woman, Mrs. S. Bella, was the only woman on the board of directors. Maybe where it says R. Dennis, secretary, it doesn't say Mr., so maybe she was a woman too. But it's just amazing what shows up on the internet. This is why you have to be very careful, Pekar. It says, "Kol devarecha b'seifin ichtavim, ayin roa, yad kotevet." You think you're going to get away with it. God doesn't know. All the Ribbono Shel has to do is turn on the internet and he has every word you ever uttered, at least in the classroom. My dear friends, ladies and gentlemen, I see a few wonderful ladies listening as well. I want to thank you so much for honoring me with your presence on the screen. And Yitzchak, thank you for sending me that piece. Actually, my youngest daughter sent it to me too. And I don't think she'll accept my answer. She must be furious with the rabbi. How did you count for the 10th person? She's wearing a dress. I Ribbono Shel Olam, imagine yet they'll give an aliyah and she'll come up to the Torah in the dress.
It's a huge shul. It's a beautiful huge shul. And they had a minyan, I think they said for Shmini Atzeret, and then they had to cancel Simchat Torah because nobody showed up. They had a picture of it. It's this amazing building.
I saw the picture. And that's Liverpool.
Maybe he's desperate, you know. He has 9.
She counts for the minyan. I did medical research. And I found out, I always wondered, what did they mean as a transsexual change? There's no way they can change you. There's no way they can change a man.
You know how to say that these days, get in trouble.
I did
hear of a post-sec who someone had done it. And he told them they should go to the one that they should consider themselves on the side. Maybe it's a married ayin thing also, because they couldn't sit on the other side of the machitza. But I did hear of a case where a posek said that they should be treated as the one they went to, not the one they started with.
But it's impossible. If you're born a man, you're a man. If you're born a woman, what's the difference? I can only tell you the Rav was quoted as, I think I heard the Rav on tape actually say it, and they were discussing this in the 1970s. I may have heard this at a conversation at the dinner table that Manny Holzer recorded of the Rav at the RCA convention, and it was off the cuff. He said what was on his mind. It was in the public talk. And they started talking about surrogate mothers and what they were developing then, and test tube babies. And the Rav said, I'm glad I won't be alive when these shilas will come up, halakha l'maisa. My dear friends, we got to end. There's another class coming in until we meet again in health and happiness. We'll pick up Sunday. You'll see Sunday an unbelievable question that came up dealing with wiping out the name, etc., etc. And I'm going to tie it in with the Israeli army. Lo pashut, these questions. But all right, we have to work the sources and give answers. Thank God for the shach. That's all I can say. Until we meet again in health and happiness, das v'danya.